This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Swuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
The presidency or the president is using, you know, that, this law or morality or championing issues around morality for his own political gain.
That's Roland Ebole, an Eastern African researcher for Amnesty International, calling Uganda's aggravated homosexuality law draconian. Also, a White House official says the U.S. is pursuing potentially viable diplomatic solutions to reverse Gabon's coup. And Nigeria's Labour Congress plans a warning strike next week to protest the cost of living. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. Nigeria has joined a growing number of nations criticizing Africa's latest coup, this time in Gabon. The Nigerian president and chair of the West African Regional Bloc, ECOWAS, says he is working with world leaders and the African Union to resolve the political crisis in Gabon, as well as in Niger, where the military recently seized power. Timothy Obiezu has more from Nigeria's capital, Abuja.
Nigerian presidential spokesman Ajuri Ingelali says President Bola Tinubu is monitoring the development in Gabon very closely and with deep concern. Ingelali says Tinubu is also worried about the seeming, quote, autocratic contagion, end quote, spreading in Africa and is working with other heads of state in Africa to fix it. Senior military men on Wednesday ousted Gabonese leader Ali Bongo Ondimba shortly after he was declared the winner of last week's controversial presidential polls. He is now under house arrest. In a video on social media, Bongo is seen asking his allies to, quote, make some noise about his removal. The junta also annulled the elections, dissolved state institutions, and closed the country's borders. Ngelali spoke to journalists in Abuja.
Power belongs in the hands of Africa's great people and not in the barrel of a loaded gun. The president affirms that the rule of law and a faithful recourse to constitutional resolutions and instruments of electoral dispute resolution must not at any time be allowed to perish from our great continent.
Gabon's coup d'etat is the eighth in Africa since August 2020 and comes 1 month after a military standoff in Niger that regional bloc ECOWAS, chaired by Tinubu, is struggling to resolve. The latest coup, which the African Union also condemned, raises concerns about the fading of the rule of law in Africa. Coups are becoming more rampant because African leaders have failed to deliver quality democratic leadership, says Rotimi Olawale, an Abuja-based political affairs analyst.
While ECOWAS has a standing reaction to coups on the continent, what the body needs to do beyond response to coup is also to sort of subject the democratic credentials of its member state to a peer review mechanism. If democracy is not working for the people, they will seek alternative means of governance that will deliver the goods for them. And many democracies on the African continent is not delivering the goods.
Emmanuel Njoku, Director of Democracy and Governance at Connected Development, a non-profit civil society group based in Abuja, says there could be more coups in the coming months.
Democracy globally is being threatened, but for Africa in particular, yeah, the kind of democracy we see in Africa, everywhere you see dictatorial democrats in power, I'm not very surprised that these things are happening today. I don't think this is the end to it. We should be expecting more.
In 2009, Ali Bongo took over the reins of power from his father, who had ruled the country for 42 years before his death. Bongo also amended the country's constitution to allow him a third term in office. On Wednesday, hundreds of people marched in Gabon's capital, Libreville, celebrating the coup and saying they had been liberated from Bongo's dynasty. Njoku had this to say in response.
This is a country that is ready for this, and yet the people are so poor. And if you look at it realistically, it's a fairly liberation for the people of Gabon. Having one family, you know, in the helm of affairs for so long, and you understand that even this president is already, you know, preparing the son to take over from him whenever he gets old.
Amid global condemnation, Gabon's hunter named General Brice Nguema as the country's transitional leader. The French news agency reports he will be sworn in on Monday. Timothy Obiezu, VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
The coup against Gabonese President Ali Bongo has challenged Gabon's political landscape and rejected an extension of the Bongo family's 56-year rule. For reaction to the military takeover, including from citizens, VOA's Anthony Labruto spoke with Francois Ngogi, a local civic candidate.
During election, we were observing a lot of flux, a lot of problems. The delayed the period for election, period for the vote, the non-respect of electoral code, the non-respect about communication of every candidate, because myself, I was a candidate for mayor places. A lot of things were observed, and it was very sad. It was very sad because this year is a sensitive year. It is a year that Gabonese people were expecting to a new thing, transition. And what people can ask today, what Gabonese people expect today? We expect a new Gabon. We are not in war against somebody. We are not in war against a political party. We are in war against a manner to do things. We are in war against the last or the old manner to do things. Army forces, yes, I'm coming, are just taking the power for what? For that people knew that in Gabon we are able to respect the right. We are able to respect the law. And they have taken the power, they have taken the opportunity, this opportunity to restore institution. That is here, what is happening now. And about Gabonese, we are expecting a new way, a new reign. New reign in what? In respecting law, in respecting rights, human rights, in respecting the right to say something, the right to work, the right to travel, the right to do something for our Gabon.
The son of Gabon's ousted president, Ali Bongo Ondimba, is incarcerated in an undisclosed location, lawyers for Bongo's wife said today. They added that they were worried for Nurdin Bongo Valentin's safety. Reuters News says after military leaders placed Bongo under house arrest on Wednesday, they ordered the arrest of his son and several members of his cabinet on accusations ranging from embezzlement to drug trafficking. Also today, the Central African Regional Bloc said it will hold a second extraordinary meeting on Monday to discuss the coup in Gabon. The Central African Regional Bloc urged partners led by the United Nations and the African Union to work to support a rapid return to constitutional order. A White House official said today the United States is pursuing potentially viable diplomatic solutions to reverse the coup in Gabon, as well as the one last month in Niger. Gabon's coup leaders said they were annulling the results of last week's presidential election after election officials said Bongo won. Bongo and his late father have controlled Gabon's government for more than 50 years. During the second Russia-Africa summit in St. Petersburg, the Moroccan Water and Energy Solutions Company signed a memorandum of understanding with Russian Smart Utilities, a subsidiary of Russia's civilian nuclear power giant, Rosatom. The agreement aims to explore developing water desalination plants in Morocco using Rosatom's technology to provide water for agriculture, industry, and human consumption. Elizabeth Myers, an American political analyst living in Morocco, discussed with VOA senior analyst Mohamed Al-Shanawi the Moroccan cooperation with Russia.
Well, this potential Russia-Morocco collaboration has actually been talked about since about 2017. Morocco has known that it's been facing a critical water shortage, and we're still, again, this year in the worst drought in 40 years, and climate change is being felt here every day. For example, irrigation water for crops right now is having to be diverted to meet the demand for drinking water. So not only is this a crisis of water scarcity for drinking, but the cost of food has been rising dramatically, and with climate change, that is not going to turn itself around. So Morocco has adopted this proactive approach with its national water strategy that's allocated nearly 400 billion dirhams, which is about $40 billion, to address the water challenges over the next 30 years using a portfolio of solutions. So one of these solutions is the seawater desalination. Morocco already has about 9 plants, and it's seeking to build about 12 more. But so this Russia-Morocco cooperation could really be a game changer for Morocco. It will enable Morocco to power its own desalination plants with nuclear energy produced on its own soil and fueled by its own domestically produced supply of uranium.
Morocco sits on about 73% of the world's phosphate rock reserves, which happens to also hold an estimated 6.9 million tons of uranium, the largest supply available in any country. How could that wealth be used to achieve plans for agricultural development in Morocco?
Agriculture already accounts for about 88% of Morocco's water usage. But the long-term vision of Morocco's King Mohammed VI is energy independence. And I think they're looking at that, trying to go for that within the next decade or so. And so unlocking cost-efficient access to nuclear power is critical not only for Morocco's current and future water crisis and its ability to continue to produce agricultural products, but it also solves the, quote, trilemma of the water-food-energy nexus. So a nuclear-fueled desalination complex can not only produce potable water, but it can serve the cooling needs of the nuclear power plants that generating the power that runs them. Nuclear power can also complement Morocco's already sizable renewable energy portfolio. And Morocco's target is actually to have 80% of its energy supplied by renewable sources by 2050. So this is very significant to add a nuclear generation option, because in addition, in the longer term, I think that Morocco is eyeing perhaps even serving as a storage hub for European energy.
Morocco has been a strong ally of the United States for a long time. How would the new cooperation with Russia impact Moroccan partnership with the U.S.?
In my opinion, it won't impact it very much. Morocco and the U.S. have had their special relationship that goes back for several centuries. And this Morocco-Russia deal, or potential deal, is emblematic, really, of the trend that many African countries are going through right now, which is that they are increasingly becoming more and more independent and are looking to become more self-sufficient and not rely on the U.S. or Europe for their future development. And this is particularly true when those countries have their own resources to exploit, such as Morocco's huge reserves of phosphates and embedded uranium. Morocco is already the world's second largest importer of Russian oil, which is subject already to U.S. sanctions. So as a pragmatic matter, for Morocco's purposes, Russia appears to be ahead of the U.S. in making this technology available for commercial purposes. And if Russia is willing to share the technology and know-how to help Morocco get to where the king's vision wishes to take the country, and if the price is right, I expect Morocco to take full advantage of that opportunity to benefit the kingdom and its population, both as a future energy powerhouse and to combat the critical shortages Morocco will be facing in the future if it does not prepare for such crises now.
That was Elizabeth Myers, an American political analyst living in Morocco, speaking with VOA's Mohammed Al-Shenawi. You're listening to African News Tonight. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. For more information on these and other stories from the continent, please see voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. For world news, check out voanews.com. If you are in Sudan witnessing events taking place there, or if you have family you are talking to there, you can call us on WhatsApp and let us know how things are going there. Dial the international code +1, then 202-258-3076. The number again, the international code +1, then 202-258-3076. The Nigerian Labour Congress said today it plans a warning strike on Tuesday and Wednesday to protest the rising cost of living after the government scrapped a petrol subsidy. The NLC, which represents millions of workers, said the strike will demonstrate readiness due to start on September 21st. Unions have been on strike a month ago over the highest inflation in two decades, but suspended their action following an offer of talks with the government. The talks did not result in concessions sufficient to placate organized labor. Nigeria's presidency and labor ministry did not immediately respond to requests for comments. A 20-year-old Ugandan man is facing the possibility of the death penalty after being charged this week with aggravated homosexuality for allegedly having unlawful intercourse with a 41-year-old man. The recently approved law has fairly widespread support in Uganda, but the country is facing pressure from the outside to repeal it. Earlier this month, the World Bank said it would not consider new loans to Uganda because of the law. Roland Dibole, an East African researcher with Amnesty International, tells VOA's Carol Van Dam, the rights group considers the law overly broad and draconian.
We are opposed to the death penalty, you know, at all cost. The law itself is very discriminatory, and not just discriminatory to persons who express themselves as, you know, as in having, you know, same-sex relations, but also their allies, because it also condemns or proscribes promotion. And promotion is very vague. So for an NGO or an organization or media house that will be seen to even call, you know, for the rights of same-sex relations people, they have, you know, they'll be penalized. It calls for, you know, neighbors, family, friends to out, you know, people who, you know, have the same-sex relations. So it actually basically gives them a responsibility, not a responsibility, but an obligation to out these people.
I would imagine there might be scenarios where if there's bad blood between people, you know, they'll use this law against a person and just to wreak havoc in their life and, you know, tell authorities that this person has done this aggravated homosexuality charge against someone else when they haven't.
Most definitely, even before the aggravated cases, just the law as it is, you know, we have reports of landlords who have evicted tenants who are of same-sex relation. We have cases whereby communities, neighbors have violently attacked people who identify themselves as such. But again, now on aggravated, and you are right, it just calls for somebody to even, you know, fix want to fix somebody, because it is not the first time we've seen this happening in Uganda. We have previous cases and recorded as such of people who have been put on death row just because of conflict and family conflict about land.
Most lawmakers will not pass a law that's hugely unpopular with most of the public. What about this law? How much support does it have among regular people in Uganda?
Incidentally, it kind of has support, and kind of has support to the people because of the religious population, Christian and Muslims in Uganda, you know, Christian forming the majority of, you know, the religious lot in Uganda. That said, it does not mean that It is one of those priority laws that Uganda needed because the population of people in Uganda have lived with the LGBTI community for ages. And what we witnessed or have witnessed before is, you know, pocket of cases of maybe discrimination among individuals, but not this form of criminalization where, you know, it leads to hate and violence. It has taken some kind of a way in which the presidency or the president is using, you know, that, you know, this law or morality or championing issues around morality for his own political, you know, gains that are happening in the region, whereby authoritarian governments are increasingly passing moral laws just to get popularity of the people.
Are you worried because of that kind of attitude and sentiment about morality laws that it is going to spread to other countries in the region?
There is already a lot of that happening. There was a debate in Kenya just a few, months ago. Kenya wanted to go the same way to pass a law. There are discussions in Burundi. There are discussions in Zambia.
That's Roland Ibole, a researcher for Amnesty International in its East Africa office. He was speaking with my colleague Carol Van Dam from Nairobi, Kenya. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiya Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent, 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Nabil Biagio, and our engineer, Cornelius Tanner, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
An editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
There are numerous challenges facing Libya as it seeks to create conditions conducive to elections. One of those is the outbreak of violence in the country and broader region, said U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas Greenfield.
Persistent grievances cannot be resolved through more fighting. That is abundantly clear. And with instability growing in places such as Sudan and Niger, factions within Libya must avoid actions that could precipitate a spiral into wider violence.
The best path forward for the Libyan people is to consolidate support for elections as soon as possible, urged Ambassador Thomas Greenfield.
All parties, the House of Representatives, the High State Council, Government of National Unity, Libyan National Army, and Presidential Council need to come together to make the necessary compromises required to hold elections.
The Libyan people are ready for compromise that will bring about elections and stability. Toward that end, noted Ambassador Thomas Greenfield, we are open to supporting the formation of a technocratic caretaker government whose sole task would be to bring the country to free and fair elections. With regard to revenue management, we are encouraged by the unification of the central bank and establishment of a high financial committee, noted Ambassador Thomas Greenfield. This Libyan-led effort will ensure no single player has exclusive control over public expenditures, and it will help address legitimate grievances over equitable revenue distribution. The committee must emphasize transparency and fiscal oversight to win the confidence of the Libyan people. The United States is encouraged by efforts to remove foreign forces, fighters, and mercenaries, and advance efforts toward possible disarmament, demobilization, and reintegration. Recent progress toward the formation of a joint unit that would patrol the south will help secure Libya's borders and prevent the spillover of regional turmoil, noted Ambassador Thomas Greenfield. The United States will continue to shine a spotlight on the Wagner Group's pernicious impact in Libya and across Africa, declared Ambassador Thomas Greenfield.
Let's be clear. Countries with Wagner deployments within their borders find themselves poorer, weaker, and less secure. We see that in Mali, Burkina Faso, Niger, and Sudan. Wagner's leadership has made no secret of its ambition to gain a further foothold in Africa and its disregard for Libya's territorial integrity.
The Libyan people deserve change, said Ambassador Thomas Greenfield. They deserve progress. They deserve hope. And it is up to Libya's leaders to take action and deliver results.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.